You're in tune to KVSC FM. We want to be your information station. Also, you're listening to the only St. Cloud station covering the entire music spectrum. KVSC St. Cloud, 88.5. First on your FM dial.
And good evening. It's 51 minutes past 10 o'clock. This is 88.5 FM KVSC. With us in the studios this evening, Tom and Harry Chapin, who perform tonight in Stuart Hall Auditorium. Welcome to our studios, Tom, Harry.
Good to be here.
To start things off, let's go back into the past a bit. You come from a very musically minded family. Your father, I heard he was with the one of the big bands.
Yeah, well, he was with Tommy Dorsey and Woody Herman and Tony Pastor and a bunch of those groups.
Glenn Grey.
Yeah, he was and is a jazz drummer who wrote the Bible for modern jazz drumming. It's a book that sold over 200,000 copies called Advanced Techniques for the Modern Jazz Drummer Coordinated Independence. And it's a chewy title and a very hard-to-play book, but it's sort of like probably more important in modern jazz than any other drum book. And come from an artsy-fartsy family, writers, painters, teachers, musicians, sculptresses, poets, filmmakers, whatever.
What do you mean artsy-fartsy?
Well, no, just, you know, people are, you know, all different versions of
not artsy. Artsy-fartsy.
Well, that's your problem.
Oh, is that my problem?
The nice thing about growing up in this kind of environment was, I mean, you had no awe of the artistic process. You know, you just do it. It's like, it's something that you enjoy doing, but you have to work hard at, and there's no mystique. You don't suddenly have the Lord come down, sit on your shoulder, and spit lightning bolts in your ears. It's
thank God.
That would be scary, actually. No, but I've been waiting for my first stroke of genius, but it hasn't happened yet. It's mostly a lot of strokes of the pen, a lot of editing. By the way, it's Andre Segovia's consented to join us tonight to give a little meaning to our music here.
I want to know what all these people in the studio are doing here. This is the crowdest, the most crowded, more people in the studio.
No, they're here to ask us questions, Tom.
Oh, well, ask us a question, for God's sake.
Would anybody like to start off with any questions?
I'll start off with this question.
Okay, Mark Skogman.
I'd like to ask you, Harry, how you happened to come to write a sequel to Taxi.
Well, I saw The Girl Again early last year, and I never thought I would do it, but most of my stuff is either triggered by things that have happened to me or things. As a matter of fact, they just asked me to cut a short version of it. So when I got into town a little early, and only time will tell. That's about 20 seconds long.
It sounded like what you did on Bananas last night.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. I cut out a version of Bananas. Last night we were in La Crosse, and for some reason I dropped out a whole verse of Bananas. Tonight I did the... Yeah. Was that with Tom? Don't you remember? How soon you forget?
This is Monday night.
Tom, say something brilliant. Rescue this.
Everything I've been saying is brilliant. You guys are just too dumb to realize.
No, anyway, it's the title of the new album, and it frankly is more true than the first. The original Taxi was only about 66% true. The girl did marry a rich guy instead of becoming an actress, and I did get a hack license instead of, becoming a pilot. I'd gone to the Air Force Academy, but the day I was supposed to start driving, I never actually drove. I got 3 film job offers. I was a filmmaker back then. Mm-hmm. But I flashed on what it'd be like if the girl had gotten aboard the cab, and, you know, what would have happened. Well, but I did see her early last year, and she's changed a lot, and I've changed a lot, and so we talked, and that pretty much what I told in the story sequel is what happened.
The track sequel is on your new album. When is that being released?
Second week in October.
In October.
About October 10th or something like that. It's on the Columbia computer, they tell me, which is next to being listed by God.
Well, I'd like to say that it's really neat to see you come back to your older material and expand on it. It's really interesting, and it's really nice to have artists that are still writing things about real life.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, my career has been sort of strange, in between disco and new wave and a million other different forms. I haven't changed. I'm always doing story songs, and I've had different kinds of production and stuff. But I must admit, I feel more secure in front of an audience than in a studio, because the process of communicating with somebody right in front of you is like a conversation. You know what the other side, But if you're communicating into a microphone that goes onto a tape, which then goes to the vinyl and then gets sold 3 to 4 months later to people who are in a completely different context, you know, they could be ironing, they could be at work, they could be doing studies, they could be making love or whatever. I hope the latter. But anyway, the bottom line of it is that I think my most successful work has been in a concert situation, but I'm very proud of the new album. I think it's the best I've done. It's got also that Story of a Life song, the second song I did tonight, is on it, and there's a bunch of other things that I think. It's a song called I Miss America, small M on Miss America, and but it also is dedicated partially to Bert Parks. But I think when you hear the album, I think you'll feel that I'm onto something in terms of what I'm talking about. Time's got a new album coming out too, by the way, in about 5-6 weeks, called Bridges.
Tom, could you tell us something about it?
Well, I like it. it's an album of songs which is called a Bridges between myself and various things. A song called Willie on it, which I'm really excited about. I'm not sure if it's going to be a single or not. There's a thanks, Eric. He blew his nose. It wasn't the raspberry. It's the same label as Harry, as a matter of fact, Boardwalk Records. It's a funny. I went down to play on Harry's album, and while I was there, Harry and I grabbed Neil Bogart, threw him up against the wall, and we tied him up, and I played him about 11 songs, and he finally said, "Okay, I'll sign you if you stop singing." No, actually, I sang him some songs, and he really loved them, and so we just.
So ones he did tonight. He did Crystal Green tonight. Did Silver Body, or I'll Be Fine.
I didn't do Willie, but that was one of those. Those three were the things. I've been recording Miami with the Albert Brothers, who did a number of different people. Harry's latest album for one, but also they've done things like Crosby, Stills and Nash and Stephen Stills, and
they produced. Did the engineering for Layla. A whole bunch of other, you know, famous records.
That Miami, you know, the Miami sound and stuff is theirs. And I'm really pleased about it. I got to tell you that I've been carrying songs around for three and a half years, and I feel like I'm finally, you know, got them out.
Gave birth, Tom. It's a long...
Well, yeah, sort of.
When did you say the album going to be released?
I'm not really sure. We don't have a release date yet, but I think it'll be somewhere in November.
This is your second release?
This is my second. Mm-hmm. The first one was on Fantasy Records. I went from Make-A-Wish to Fantasy.
Going back to one of the songs that was done tonight, WOLD, and I've noticed in some of your other songs that you performed, you often refer to radio. And I was wondering, have you two had any experience in actual radio other than having your disc?
Well, I've done a bunch of guest disc jockey shots, but the basic thing is that two things. Number one, when you get involved in the music industry, you by definition get involved in radio, and indeed I, you know, spent a lot of time after Taxi came out traveling around and doing a bunch of promotional work. The second thing is a lot of analogies between being a disc jockey and a singer, you know. Although singers get a chance to go from town to town night by night, an awful lot of disc jockeys don't spend more than 3 or 4 months at a station at a time. That even, you know, a young veteran of the radio industry, like 25, 26, may have been at 10 stations already. And also, in many cases, you're talking and performing for audiences that you never see. Many performers, maybe unlike Tom and I, because we really do have an inner relationship with an audience, but basically go out on stage, have spotlights in their eyes. All the only thing they have from an audience is... and then the show ends. And every year they get older, and every year their audience stays the same age in many cases. And being a disc jockey is an interesting profession because it's you essentially most of the time, unlike this one, we've got a lot of people in the studio, but you're having a one-man or one-woman party with the active faith that there's somebody out there listening. And anyway, it's interesting. That's why I wrote the song.
If you're a musician anyway, you listen to the radio at least as much as any normal person, probably more so, because you're really interested in what's happening. And people always ask you, what do you listen to? And of course, as a musician, you listen to everything, you know. Anything from... I've been really interested in the new wave thing, even though a little bit really touches me. But I've been very interested in the whole idea of being back to minimal things, you know.
Do you feel your interest in new wave is going to affect your music in the future? Or
it's hard to say because everything affects your music, you know, everything, you know, your life. But I doubt it's going to affect them. I'm not going to be a punk, you know, I'm not going to go into that thing, if that's what you mean.
I wore a dress tonight. I don't know if you noticed that, but makeup, the whole bit.
The song Cats in the Cradle, which was a 1974 smash, written by your wife for your
son. She wrote the lyrics, yeah. I stole it from her. And it was a poem, basically, and I stole it, made it rhyme, and made it into a song, and it was number one the last week of 74.
Now, it was made for Josh?
My son Josh, yeah,
right.
The Cats in the Cradle kid. He's now seven. And it's, scarily enough, still applies to me because I do run around the country too much, not enough time at all.
Do you see him going into music, or has he shown any musical interest?
Well, I really, you know, there's another song called Dancing Boy on the Living Room Suite album which talks about him doing that. But the bottom line of it is that we don't really put pressure on any of our kids or our family to do anything specific. We became musicians, I think, because in many ways Dad looked like he was having the most fun of all of us in the family. But in general, I think kids find their own space, their own place, and the key is to make sure in their upbringing that they get a chance to taste, to touch, to feel, to experience a whole bunch of different things, including, you know, music.
And that it's possible.
Are there any other questions? Okay, Gail Ivers.
I work at KVSC. Do you write your own guitar music?
Yeah, we arrange everything. As a matter of fact, when you're a singer-songwriter on the guitar, you almost generally arrange the song as you write it on the guitar. Then you, when you go with your group, and or in Tom's case, you know, recording, then you add and embellish as you go along. You sometimes find you take away a couple of things you had originally written into it, and in many cases you add. But I think both of us are highly. We don't just strum the guitar when we're writing our music. Most of it has a sort of a form that comes with it in the writing. Don't you feel that, Tom?
Yeah, both of us tend to start with lyric. And an idea, and maybe a musical idea, but generally it's a lyric idea, and then you find a way to work on it. Because you're composing on the guitar, you find a way that works. Harry was talking, somebody asked him yesterday about his guitar playing, and he said he just played very functional guitar, and so do I. You know, we both play guitar that as an accompanying instrument, not as a solo instrument, really.
I noticed that you both strum up on the frets a lot, and I've never seen that done. But I was really interested. Yes.
Well, if you look at any rock guitarist, they're playing up there.
What I was thinking was, no, I noticed that you did a lot of harmony on the guitars. Do you write that up for your own song and then the other one learns it? Or
well,
do you
basically,
work it together,
I mean,
enough?
Tom's stuff, I just try to find something that's simple, doesn't get in the way, and embellishes it, and vice versa. One of the things you do when you have two guitars is maybe one person capos up the neck to make sure that it's in a different range.
So, like, for instance, I would be playing down here. If I'm playing lead and Harry's playing, you know, helping it, I'd be playing down here like this. And he might be playing way up in the neck, and just so it has a different fullness. Or you play just very... Over the years, look, I've been playing since I was 12 years old, and that's a long time, and over the years you find things that work, basically. I wouldn't call either of us a brilliant guitarist, but we're both very serviceable.
I'm startlingly adequate in what I do.
He plays like he talks.
Yeah. Yeah. But I got my nose fixed now. My mouth doesn't work. No, but it's funny because Tom really can play in a lot of different styles, but the only thing I can do is do Harry Chapin music. But I work very hard when I find a song that's developing. I work very hard to find something that's indigenous to or aid and embellish the story. And if it means that I have to upgrade my guitar playing to do that, I do it. But then I don't say, gee, I'm going to learn a new technique to apply to a million different songs. What I do is work very hard to arrange each song for what I do. So I used to in the old days, just as Tom did, play an awful lot of people's music because we did a lot of people's music. But I've become sort of literally one-dimensional right now as a musician because I'm basically interested in exploring an area which I'm sort of a category of one, these story songs. And to me, the body of work that I'm most proud of ranges from, you know, Taxi to WOLD to Mr. Tanner to Better Place to Be and then a bunch that are less well-known, Bummer or Corey's Coming or... Stranger with the Melodies, or Greyhound, or Sniper, or a bunch of extended narrative pieces that are not repetitive with anything else going on. They're not new wave. They're not disco. They're not folk rock. They're really just. I have sort of come up with an area that is uniquely mine, and I think that's why, in a way, this year I'm doing better than I've ever done before at a time when the music industry is in terrible, terrible shape. We played to more people this year, made more money, gave away more money than ever before. And ironically enough, at the same time when theoretically music industry is in trouble, that Tom is working an awful lot, is going to be doing his first album in 3.5 years, 4 years. And it's, I mean, the music industry has almost come back to us. And the reason is very simple. That our values are very simple. We do what we do that we care about, and we treat our audiences with respect because they're the people who allow us to do it. We don't act like they're doing us. I mean, we're doing them a favor. We act like they're doing us a favor. And if you respect the people you need to make the musical communicative experience happen, I think you're going to always have a career. And we're finding that every year it gets better.
I thought that your rapport on stage with each other was really good. Have you ever done an album just the two of you together?
No, maybe someday in the future. We're talking. There's a bunch of projects that we're dealing with that are pending. We just did a major TV special up in Canada, and I don't know if it'll get down in the States or Tom and I.
If the strike keeps going on, we'll think we'll be pulling everything out. Maybe we'll get on. I don't know. There's a lot of possibilities, but a solo album, a double album, we haven't. You know, there's a lot of things before that happens.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Next question is from Andy Glass, music director, KVSC.
Okay, you guys wowed them on Capitol Hill when you brought up your idea for the commission that Carter did.
Yeah.
In this year of presidential elections, a noted historian remarked that it was ironic how the country that brought us George Washington brought us this bunch of, quote, crumbums. You've been in Washington. What do you think of the political system and the politicians today and what they're doing for the world's problems?
Well, I mean, Carter was nice enough to appoint me to his commission, but it wasn't because of any deep emotional commitment to me or the problem. It was basically because we bullied him with a resolution from Congress that was passed unanimously in the Senate, 434 to 38 in the House, 334 to 38 in the House, and indeed we generated more mail to the White House between Thanksgiving and New Year's 1977 than Vigory and all the right-wing people were able to generate over the Panama Canal. Tom was with me when we introduced the resolution. We sang on the steps of Capitol Hill. I had done a ton of benefits to various congressmen and senators. I'd met about 35 senators, 150 congressmen. I'd spent, you know, one 17-day period I didn't touch a bed. I was sleeping in planes, traveling back and forth from benefit concerts, back to Washington, lobbying all day, and then flying back out again. I'm serious about the issue. As I mentioned at the concert, you know, Gene McCarthy had a line about football that applies to pop music. You know, you got to be smart enough to play the game and dumb enough to think it matters. However, I must admit, I'm not a person that beats on politicians too much. I criticize them, but I'm not surprised. The major surprise in America today is not rich people who always do what rich people do, which is to hold on to the money, poor people who always do what poor people do, which is to struggle, institutions which always become, you know, having hardened arteries and try to become hidebound and unflexible and try to become entrenched, leaders who always do what leaders do, which is try to hold on to their power. The major surprise in America is the so-called enlightened middle class. It would be the middle class that's been college-educated, that has got enough money so that they can think about, you know, 4 weeks of vacation a year and send their kids to college and, you know, think about the better life. And these are the people, we the people, in this society where this Constitution was literally biased for us. You've got to remember in 1787, when they passed the Constitution, in New York State, for example, there were 300,000 people, of which only 12,000 were eligible to vote. And guess who they were? They were white, they were male, they were 21, they were property owners, they were literate, they lived in the same place for 3 years. And the point is that there was a bias in the society towards us being the ombudsman, the people smart enough, caring enough to ask the first, second, third, fourth, tenth, 20th questions about defense, about education, about environment, about economics, about hunger, about all a raft of questions. And to the extent that the level of debate in this society is as low as it is from our leaders, is really a comment on our interest. The fact that 38.8% of America bothered to vote in the 78 elections, the lowest turnout in American history, is again a comment mainly on us. So if you want to know where the major surprises are in America, look in the mirror, look at us, and realize that we are really not doing that kind of qualitative job. Again, the history of humanity is the history of activated minorities. What was truly unique about America, and is unique, if we still believe in it and want to activate that, is that activated citizenry right in the middle, who are involved in the political process and cannot be bullshat to or at. So that's a technical term used in the politics business, so don't worry about getting it censored. So anyway, the bottom line of all of this is that I am not surprised that we have mediocrity in Washington, because we ourselves are accepting more and more the kind of doublethink that George Orwell talks about, where you hold mutually exclusive truths in our heads at the same time.
And we know that we're more and more just worrying about ourselves, looking at our navels, saying boogie, and hope that the whole world goes away and doesn't bother us, when we know that in the final analysis, that is not going to be true, that we're doing a bunch of wishful thinking. I think any one of you, if I sat down with you and asked you basic questions about the givens that you know, that's coming through the media, TV, radio, newspapers, and your reading and your friends, you would be saying things that are far wiser than Mr. Reagan or Mr. Carter or Mr. Anderson are saying. The problem is that the question is whether we're willing to actualize. End of monologue.
Okay, getting back to that commission, if I'm not mistaken, the foundation of it was that you weren't going to hand in another paper and go home, go to bed, feel you'd done your Christian duty. You're going to find out what the problem was and actually do something about it.
Well, you're right at the nitty-gritty point question, and we're right at the nitty-gritty right now, and that is that we are writing an omnibus bill to take into account the recommendations of the commission. I, during this month, are doing 23 out of 24 concerts as benefits. For example, tomorrow night I'm going to Moscow, not Russia, Moscow, Idaho, to perform at Idaho State for Senator Frank Church, who is the head of the Foreign Relations Committee in the Senate. I, over the last 4 weeks, have done 9 congressional and senatorial benefits. Over the next 5 weeks, we'll be doing another 13 of them. These are key people in the Agriculture Committee in both the House and the Senate, and the Foreign Relations Committee in both the House and the Senate, allies that will need to help get through this bill. We're talking about a complete reevaluation and reallocation of about $5 billion, which is a pittance compared to what we're spending in other things. We could talk about putting $65 billion into an MX missile system in the desert in Utah and Nevada. It'll be the largest cement-using project in the history of mankind. It'll take more water to mix that cement than the state of Nevada has right now. They'll have to import water to mix that cement. Meanwhile, we've got 20 million Americans malnourished, 500 million people around the world malnourished, and this has been a good year. It's crazy. But anyway, to make a long story short, over the next 6 months to the year, we will be submitting the legislation and indeed making sure that hopefully the money we send doesn't go to right-wing SOBs like Marcos, Somoza, Batista, Trujillo, or the Shah, or any of those people we've been supporting over the years, and actually going to countries who have a commitment to basic human needs for their own populations. In many cases, our foreign aid just goes to the upper crust in these other societies for political and economic reasons that have nothing to do with the poor people. Same is true here in the United States.
Thank you. Next question, Sharon Kressler.
I'm afraid I don't have a very good transition, but I remember watching Make-A-Wish when I was a little girl, and I hope that doesn't make you feel too old, but I was wondering... I was wondering if that was your big start or how that helped your career or whatever.
It's interesting, because when I was doing that show, I always sort of thought it was a sidelight. It took me a month and a half in the summer. It was like a vacation in the summer doing this show, and the rest of the time I was a starving musician playing in a rock and roll band. And the guys in the band said, kids, children, you want to be a Captain Kangaroo, you know. And I just did the show. And I didn't realize really until the show was over what kind of impact it had. It was a delight to do. We spent the first year we did it in New York City, and I lived there. And that was the year that Harry got back in music. And we were playing at night, and Harry was writing the songs. And the next morning he'd call me up at 6 o'clock, and I'd learn the 3 songs and go record them that day. Did that for a month and a half. Then I went back and played music the whole fall and winter and spring. And then the next summer we went to London and did a month and a half. The next year it was Spain. And then the next year it was Greece. And the last year it was a bicentennial. It was Philadelphia. Anyway, it was a wonderful thing. In terms of my career, I guess it was the reason that most people know me. Frankly, the people know me for 2 things at this point. One is Make-A-Wish, and some from Every Day, and some for being Harry's brother. And now, actually, I've been playing enough concerts, so actually that's not quite true, because a lot of people realize that I'm a performer in my own right. But that I guess, was the reason that I got to play a lot. I started as a single about 5 years ago. And the reason I got any jobs at all was because of Make-A-Wish. I was very fond of the show. On the other hand, when it was over, I didn't cry because it had been 5 years, which is a long time in television. And I was ready to do something different. And I'm, as Harry and I were talking, this beat's working. You know, people complain about the tough life on the road and this and that. Well, maybe it's all true in a relative sense, but this is a wonderful life. You get a chance to get a lot of feedback. You're performing your own creations, which is a very rare thing to do. Painters don't get a chance to perform their thing. But you write a song, you get a chance to perform it. So you get it both ways. So it ain't a bad life. It's one of the reasons why Harry and I, to a lesser degree, are involved in some of these charity things, because it is such a good life, you get to feel guilty.
Thank you.
Well, whenever I need somebody, Tom's always there. So by definition, he's the second most active supporter of World Hoogier. Well, I'd like to wind up this thing, because we've got to wind our way back to the airport. Tom's taking off early tomorrow morning from New York, and I'm taking off from Moscow, Idaho. But this is a song that ends the my new album that Tom played guitar on. As a matter of fact, that's Tom's guitar in the background you're hearing right now. And it's a song that I dedicated on the album to Alan Lowenstein, who is one of my three heroes, along with Pete Seeger and Ralph Nader. Al got shot this past April by a disaffected former worker in the Mississippi summer back in 1963, when an awful lot of college students had a larger vision about what and who they are and what they needed to offer the society. And I dedicated this song to Al, and it's called Remember When the Music. Remember when the music came from wooden boxes strung with silver wire, and as we sang the words, it would set our minds on fire, for we believed in things, and so we'd sing. Remember when the music would bring us all together to stand inside the rain, and as we joined our hands, we'd meet in the refrain. For we had dreams to live, we had hopes to give. Remember when the music was the best of what we dreamed of for our children's time, and as we sang, we worked, for we knew time was just a line. A gift we saved, a gift the future gave. Oh, all the times I listened, and all the times I heard, all the melodies I'm missing, and all the magic words, and all those potent voices, and the choices we had then. How I'd love to find we had that kind of choice again. Remember when the music was the glow on the horizon of every newborn day, and as we sang, the sun came up to chase the dark away, for life was good, and we knew we could.
Brought the night across the valley as the day went down, and as we'd hum the melody, we'd be safe inside the sound, and so we'd sleep. We had dreams to keep.
And now I dream that something's coming, and it's not just in the wind. It's more than just tomorrow, it's more than where we've been. It's something like a promise, it's something like begin. Don't you know we're needing something worth believing in? Don't you remember when the music came from wooden boxes strung with silver wire? And as we sang the words, it would set our minds on fire. For we believed in things, and so we'd sing, and so we'd sing.